Program are those of the host and the participants.
Bonjour. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host today, Bob McChesney, on WILL AM 580. Here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, we've got a live show coming to you. And our guest today, joining us on the phone from her home in Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Susan Douglas, who's the Catherine Neefe Kellogg Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Michigan. Susan Douglas, the author of several outstanding books on popular culture and media history, including Listening In, Radio and the American Imagination, which won the Hacker Prize in 2000 for the best popular book about technology and culture, and Where the Girls Are, Growing Up Female with the Mass Media, a highly acclaimed book which came out a few years back. And then finally, Inventing American Broadcasting, 1899 to 1922, a trailblazing work that came out in the 1980s, growing out of Susan's dissertation. Her new book, co-authored with Meredith Michaels, is called The Mommy Myth, The Idealization of Motherhood and How It Has Undermined Women, published by Free Press just out this year. And Susan Douglas, thank you for joining us on the air here.
Hi, Bob. It's great to be back with you.
It's really a pleasure to have you on, Susan, and I've had the privilege of going through your book the last couple of days, and it's really a wonderful book.
Oh, thanks so much.
It's really well written, too. Whenever I have a professor on the show or an academic, I always have to, you know, I think there's a guard that goes on among people that the book will be dry and jargony and lack humor and wit and insight, or at least popular insight, and that is not the case with this book. I think people will find it a very enjoyable read. And a very trenchant read, for that matter, too.
Well, I hope so. You know, it was really important that this book be funny for a variety of reasons. So I'm glad with that you found it so.
Well, Susan Douglas, why don't you start off and tell us, you know, what is the mommy myth, and why did you write this book, and what's it about?
Well, the mommy myth is a highly romanticized and utterly demanding myth of the perfect mother, in which the standards are so high, so absurdly high, that they are impossible to achieve. And, you know, I really wanted to write the book to point out the enormous gap between the image of motherhood and the reality of mothers' everyday lives, and also to really try to help alleviate the enormous guilt and stress that comes with these preposterous media standards.
And it sounds like the media is really sort of centrally implicated in the mommy myth. Is that right?
Well, it is. You know, what was really important here was to remind mothers that we have a collective history as mothers that has been powerfully shaped by the media. You know, motherhood seems like such an individual effort, you know, and we're judged on our kids and how well we do, you know, in our own isolated lives. And because motherhood has become kind of, you know, so privatized and individualized, we forget that we have a common history and that the media has powerfully shaped us despite, you know, geographic differences, racial differences, class differences, etc. So I really wanted to look at how the media have framed motherhood and how so many of us as women have internalized those, you know, frameworks and standards.
Yeah, why don't you give some more concrete examples of what you mean by the mommy myth, what part of the myth is and what sort of the pressures that women feel as a result?
Well, you know, if we take, let's take a media exemplar here. Let's take June Cleaver, right? If we think of June Cleaver as the sort of prototypical, you know, perfect suburban mother from the 1950s.
And let me interrupt for 1 second, because we do have listeners who are not of our generation, Susan.
They don't know who June Cleaver is. Okay.
There might be some, because it's not, I don't think that shows that much on cable either.
It's still on TV land, Bob, believe it or not.
Okay, it is. Okay, I'm missing that show. But in any case, this is from the famous show Leave It to Beaver.
That's right, where she, you know, basically June Cleaver was known for, you know, cooking a lot, vacuuming in high heels and pearls, and installing paper towel rolls, and that's, you know, sort of what she did as a mom.
And always being in a phenomenal mood.
I mean, always in a good mood. But she's become this kind of icon of 50s motherhood. And let's just think about what even she didn't have to do. She was not expected to pipe Mozart into her womb so that her son, the beaver, came out perfectly tuned. She wasn't expected to drill him with flashcards when he was 6 months old. She wasn't expected to make sure he could read the Iliad by the time he was in kindergarten. She never had to drive the beaver 10 hours round trip to a soccer match. I mean, you know, it's just, she could not do what mothers are expected to do today. and our to-do list has gotten very long, and it really is about building the perfect kid. To build a perfect kid, you're supposed to be a supermom.
Indeed. And we're talking to Susan Douglas today, the co-author of the new book, The Mommy Myth, co-authored with Meredith W. Michaels. It's just come out with Free Press, and the subheading of The Mommy Myth is The Idealization of Motherhood and How It Has Undermined Women. If you'd like to call in and have a question or comment for Susan Douglas, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Well, we've got this sort of extraordinarily high standard for mothers that is presented to them in our culture. What drives it? I mean, there are a lot of mothers. Why isn't there countervailing forces to have a much more realistic and sustainable vision?
Well, you know, I think that we're surrounded by so many different interlocking, you know, media images and messages that it's very hard to resist as an individual. So, I mean, let's just think back, you know, how we've gotten to this place. You know, the women's movement in the 1970s sought to challenge motherhood as it was institutionalized back then. And really what that meant in the 60s before the women's movement was every woman, no matter what her talents were, what she might hope to do, every woman was expected to be a wife and mother. And if she worked when she got married, to quit her job as soon as the kids came. And it was a really one-size-all image of motherhood in which women were meant to be economically and emotionally dependent on their husbands. Well, the women's movement really challenged that, and you saw a revolution in the family in the 1970s and early 80s, and the women's movement played a role, but so did the economy. The economy was terrible. Mothers of small children had to go to work, and the divorce rate also soared, and many women found themselves single and having to support a family. And so it's not surprising that the mass media would respond to these enormous changes. But here's what began to happen. First, in the early and mid-1980s, the news media discovered the endangered child as a news-grabbing story. And endangered kids became a highly sensationalized news story. So we started to get, for example, stories about Halloween candy filled with razor blades, you know, which later turned out to be an urban legend, but it circulated throughout the media. We had stories about daycare centers allegedly staffed by Satanists and pornographers. And as we now know, most of those stories ended up being false, but at the time they scared people to death about daycare centers. There were missing children everywhere, and the news media trafficked in highly exaggerated and inaccurate figures about how many kids were going missing. So as a result of those kinds of news stories, mothers became terrified of letting their kids out of their sight. You know, we felt like we had to guard our kids with the same vigilance that Secret Service agents used to guard POTUS, you know? So fear was important. Then there was marketing. You know, marketing experts in the toy industry and elsewhere became very, very sophisticated in the 1980s, and they began to test market stuff with a lot more rigor, and they divided our kids into ever smaller demographic niches, so that now, I mean, young mothers today, their kids are divided up into like 0 to 3 months demo, you know, 3 to 6 months, 6 months to 9 months, and each of them is accompanied by a bleacher load of products that if you don't buy, you know, your kid is allegedly going to be left in the dust by the savvy smart mothers, you know, who bought their kids Einstein Jr. and Leap Pads and all the stuff that now kids are supposed to have. You know, so marketing has played a very central role, and they get our kids, and you've written about this a lot yourself, you know, they market so much to our kids, and then they market to us, so we get it twice, you know, once directly, and then the second time through our kids. But the notion of how much you have to do to cultivate and develop your child's every potential, you know, their athletic potential, their music potential, their spatial cognitive, you know, forming potential. We get hit by this all the time. And so marketing has been crucial. And then I guess, you know, my favorite really is the fantasy that comes from the celebrity mom profiles that inundate the mothers of America.
And that you write about in The Mommy Myth.
Yeah, you know, I mean, this was really one of the central reasons I, you know, started thinking about writing this book. When I had my child, I got one that did not sleep. And
I know about those, too.
You know about those, yeah, you know. And so she was up at 4:30 for the day, starting at 5 months old. And it was really grueling. And so I'd go to the supermarket, you know, at 8 in the morning, and there would be me, you know, in my husband's sweatpants, which were the only thing that fit, and a sweatshirt, you know, covered with baby spit up and hair that hadn't seen a comb in a couple of days, and a screaming infant in the car. And I go to the checkout line, and who's there? Kathy Lee Gifford, Joan London, you know, Vanna White, saying motherhood is sexy, you know. And sexy, I have to say, was really the last thing it was. And, you know, not only were the celebrity mothers perfectly made up with their perfect hair, their perfect clothes, no spit up on them, the kids were perfectly made up, and you went inside, and their houses were decorated in white. You know, white sofas, white shag rugs, this is with the toddler, you know. And what was so pernicious about them was that they were not only telling you everything that they, the perfect celebrity mothers, did to make sure their kids were going to be Nobel laureates by the time they were 12, you know, they were telling you how you were supposed to feel. And you were supposed to feel ecstatic and blissed out all the time. And, you know, for the real mothers of America who don't have a SWAT team of nannies, you know, we have slightly, you know, a wider range of feelings than bliss.
Yeah, and especially these mothers, they have a SWAT team for each kid. And so, like, if you've got three for each kid, you can have four kids. It's not a big deal. But if you don't have a SWAT team of nannies, once you go over one or two kids, it's like you're really in the quicksand.
Well, exactly. And, you know, if you're an A-list actress and you have a baby, guess what happens to you at your workplace? You have a trailer staffed by a nanny and filled with toys. So, of course, you can go on the set with your baby and, you know, go back and forth between child care and work. You know, my workplace doesn't have such a trailer, and most workplaces don't. So, you know, I think we're just bombarded with these, you know, celebrity stories that they've now gotten on TV with in-style celebrity mom profile TV shows, and those also are just filled with preposterous standards for maternal perfection, too.
We're talking to Susan J. Douglas today, the co-author of the new book, The Mommy Myth, just published by Free Press. Susan Douglas co-authored that with Meredith W. Michaels. The subhead of the book is The Idealization of Motherhood and How It Has Undermined Women. Susan Douglas is professor of communication studies at the University of Michigan, author of many outstanding books on media history and popular culture. It's a pleasure to have her join us. If you'd like to call in and ask Susan a question or have a comment, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Susan, one of the comments you made earlier about this hysteria about children sort of not being taken care of properly and being, you know, running away and being the crisis of the 70s and 80s, and with people having to monitor their children. And it really struck me because the difference you were saying with June Cleaver's era, that when I was growing up, and I suspect the same was with you, when I was a young kid, pretty much my parents didn't set up a social calendar for me that accounted for every hour of the day. Basically, they opened the door, and I had to figure out how to entertain myself with my friends in the neighborhood. And nowadays, like, you know, our kids, I feel like, you know, I'm a booking agent. I mean, do you have the same phenomenon? I mean,
absolutely. You know, and I think a lot of things have intersected to make this happen. You know, when I was a kid, and many people in my generation, you know, there were still outdoor places to play. You know, there were woods, and there were, you know, there were places to go, and there wasn't a fear that they were dangerous. And so, you know, there was just a completely different environment for kids. A lot of the places where my kid has to go, and I bet yours too, you know, they have to be driven to.
Yeah.
And so that's a big change. So, you know, we become chauffeurs and booking agents and, you know, employees in a way. And, you know, there are so many activities our kids want to get involved with, and we want them to get involved in these activities. But, you know, the terrain around kids has changed so much, and I think we feel so much, you know, obligation to make sure that they are in all of these enriching activities, and many of them are indeed great. But the extent to which our kids also actually have time to be bored, so that they have to figure out you know, go read a book or go do something, you know. That's changed, you know. My parents, like yours, did not feel that they had to be responsible for structuring our entire day. And, you know, I think that is a big change. On my parents, you know, open the door, like, go out.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, yeah, take care of yourself. I mean, yeah, I agree. It's a stunning change. You know, you've talked about the role of news media and their coverage of the new mom, nomism, or the mommy myth. There's other factors, too, that you've alluded to. One is entertainment media, and the other are advertisements, both of which I think are prominent in promulgating the mommy myth. What are some examples of how the entertainment media have sort of promoted the new vision of the idealization of motherhood?
Well, you know, I, for my sins, looked at many, many reruns of 30-something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see pictures of it in the book and references to it.
You know, and 30-something was an incredibly well-written, beautifully acted, lovingly lit, beautifully produced, and incredibly annoying television show in which you, that was where you started to see the, you know, the new momism on TV. And interestingly, you know, that show was on the air at the same time that that Roseanne was. And it had gone on the air just before Roseanne did. And so you had these real poles on TV between a show like 30-something in which the mothers were completely devoted to intensive mothering and, you know, love nothing more than crawling around on the floor with their kids, you know, after Duplos 24 hours a day. And opposite of that was Roseanne, who really tried to take, you know, the schmaltz out of motherhood and give a much more realistic, if you were, portrayal of a woman really trying to juggle work, especially a working-class woman trying to juggle work and, you know, family. But the so, you know, you have shows like 30-something, which is where I really see this you know, kind of new momism beginning in the entertainment media. And then we had this whole spate of movies that are called in the industry women in JEP films, which stands for Jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
And these began to get produced in the 1980s and 90s to air opposite Monday Night Football. And they used to be on the networks, and now they are in incessant rerun on the Lifetime network.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the basic plot of this show. A mother, usually a single mother, but not always, has her and her kid or kids feeling or being stalked, harassed, chased, raped, kidnapped, whatever, for the first hour and 55 minutes, right? And in the last 5 minutes, the mother triumphs. And, you know, these shows also basically suggest that in the end, the police are going to let you down, the cops are going to let you down, all of the institutions are going to let you down, and you, the mother, are going to have to pick up the slack. And what I find really interesting about these Women in JEP shows is that, are they schmaltzy? Yeah. Can we laugh at them? You bet. But are they also tapping into something that's very right? Yeah, I think they are, because, you know, in real life, and we can talk more about the political dimensions of this, you know, the other thing that has powerfully fueled the new momism is the fact that, you know, it is harder to be a mother or a parent in this country than in any other industrialized country in the world. We have had far right-wing attacks on single mothers, working mothers, welfare mothers, and a stubborn refusal to either, you know, support pre-existing institutions that your parents and my parents used to count on, including the public schools, plus a refusal to provide other kinds of institutions like high-quality nationally, you know, a national system of daycare, you know, across the country that every family could tap into. We don't have that. We don't have paid maternity leave. We don't have decent after-school programs. We don't have health insurance for everybody in the country, including all the kids. And so, you know, mothers look around at collapsing institutions, and what do? We figure, well, we got to pick up the slack.
We're talking to Susan J. Douglas today, the co-author of the new book, The Mommy Myth, the professor at the University of Michigan in the Department of Communication Studies. We've got a couple callers on the line. I want to go to them. If you'd like to call in and speak with Susan, the phone lines are open at 333-9455. and 1-800-222-9455 is our toll-free number. Let's go to the toll-free line. Dixon, Illinois, you're on with Susan Douglas.
Yeah, hi. A quick comment. You seem to be missing the whole secret of being the perfect mommy, and that's having the right drugs. It still counts for you, Ritalin for the kids. You know, if you pay attention to the commercials, you know, it all comes out, you know. I don't know. If you have any comments on that, I'll hang up and listen on the air.
All right, thank you. Yeah, how important is narcotics or drugs to this operation, Susan?
Well, the caller is suggesting actually two things. I mean, I think he was being facetious on the one hand, but on the other hand, he's also referring to, as I understood his call, the, you know, mass marketing now of prescription pharmaceuticals, particularly antidepressants. And in many of these antidepressant ads, which are primarily geared to women, the tagline is, I'm myself again. Now I feel to be myself again, right?
Mm-hmm.
There was this core joyful self that you used to be, but you can't be, and the drug's going to get you back there. And often what you see, the imagery that you see, is that she can't be a good mother. She's finding motherhood frustrating or exasperating. But once she takes whatever the antidepressant is, she's back, you know, doing somersaults in the park with her kid, you know. And so I think these drug ads do traffic in the same myth that the kind of normal baseline for mothers to be is joyful and thrilled, that a regular mother, a normal mother, happily goes to the park and jumps rope with her kid and, you know, does arts and crafts with him 24/7 and all the rest. So I think the caller's very right about the kind of myth of perfect motherhood that comes out in pharmaceutical ads.
How about as I understand it, fairly significant increase in antidepressant drugs or other sorts of behavior modification drugs for children? Does that tie into sort of the mommy myth and sort of the demands of the parents have upon their children to be up to certain standards as well?
Well, you know, that's a great question, Bob, and I don't know the answer to that. I think it's a terrific question, you know, but I do think that, you know, there's so much pressure on us as parents and so much pressure on our kids. And, you know, as I was working on this book, I was, of course, thinking about Barbara Ehrenreich's terrific book from the late 80s, early 90s, Fear of Falling.
Yeah, that's a masterpiece.
Yeah, it's just such a wonderful book, and it ties into this very much. We are terrified that our kids are going to kind of fall through the cracks. And, you know, I think the other thing that worms its way into here is the rankings of colleges, right? The whole, you know, U.S. News and World Report rankings.
Yeah.
So that now there are like 10 colleges or universities you're supposed to think about, and all the thousands of others are worthless. And so if your kid, you know, doesn't get into the right preschool, then he or she isn't going to go to Stanford, right? as if that's the end of the world. I mean, how did we get to this ridiculous place, you know? Things really have gotten over the top, and I think that especially in the last couple of years, they've gotten even worse.
Why do you think they've gotten worse in the last couple of years?
You know, I just think there's so much of a backlash right now against women, and it's getting powerfully manifested through standards around motherhood. And that's the, you know, that's really how I see it. I mean, I think that, you know, young women today are being sold the following kind of line around post-feminism. Here's how it goes.
Okay.
We had a feminist moment, although I'm not sure when that happened, but, you know, supposedly equality has been totally achieved for women across the board, and therefore, since it's been achieved, we can now go back with relief to sexist television programming and misogynistic jokes and, you know, entire programs based on Victoria's Secret underwear and, you know, shows about a bachelor sampling 25 women and then picking the one he likes best and so on and so forth. And I think that there's just been such a key feature of this post-feminism has been a backlash, especially against working mothers. You know, we saw this mythology this last fall. I don't know if you saw this infamous article that was in the Sunday New York Times magazine by Lisa Belkin, and that it was called The Opt-Out Generation.
Mm-hmm.
And the cover of the magazine said, why are more women not making it to the top? And the answer was, they choose not to. And inside, she profiled five highly representative women. They were all Princeton graduates who were married to guys who made six figures, right? And One of them was in broadcast journalism and was being asked to work, you know, 60 hours a week. The other was a litigator, and at one point she was being asked to work 75 hours a week. They went to their bosses because they had had children, and they said, I can't do this and have a baby. And the boss said, sorry, either choose the job or choose the kid. Now, I'm sorry, that's not a choice.
No.
That's not a choice. But what's getting bandied about, and Time Magazine just had a cover recently about this, you know, the case for staying home, right?
Yeah.
Well, inside the magazine, the article was not about the case for staying home. The article was about how the workplace remains, you know, abominably behind the times when it comes to supporting parents who work. But these covers that suggest that they're, you know, really going to stick it to working mothers, they sell, you know.
And as you pointed out earlier, these are really public policy political issues. That countries having viable health care and daycare, prenatal care, and support mechanisms for raising children don't put the same pressure on moms having to carry this burden through their life.
Well, that's exactly right, you know.
Or dads, for that matter, but moms especially.
That's right. You know, I think that if every mother, and father for that matter, could be transported to Denmark for a week and see what goes on in a civilized country, and then when they all came back, I think we'd have a revolution. You know, jobs are structured much differently. People can leave work earlier. Women have enormous support when they have children. There is government-subsidized daycare for all kids. Now, are their taxes higher? Yes. But they've made a choice as a society about what they want to support and how they want to live their lives. I just did a reading recently, and a woman from New Zealand was in the group, and she was talking about what a shock it was to come to the United States with a small child, because in New Zealand, you get a year off. It's not paid, but it's a year off, and your job is guaranteed to be there when you get back. And there is free subsidized daycare for children starting, I believe it's at the age of 3. I can't remember if it's younger. But see, in these countries, daycare is not seen as a special interest for working mothers. It's seen as a developmentally enriching program for all kids. You know, it's just a completely different philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just at the moment when families were going through unprecedented changes, which was in the late 70s and early 80s, you know, Reagan came into power. And the philosophy of Reaganism was defund the federal government, right? Strip back everything and also demonize the federal government. Suggest that the federal government, that any kind of support system that come from the state are ipso facto corrupt, wasteful, can't do the job right. And so just at the moment when what we really needed was the equivalent of the a GI Bill for families was when a philosophy of government came in that said, let the market decide, federal government is evil, corrupt, wasteful, and we're not going to do anything. And so we've been stuck here ever since. And, you know, I really think it's time for mothers' voices to be heard on this.
We're talking to Susan J. Douglas today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Sue Douglas is the co-author with Meredith Michaels of the new book, The Mommy Myth, The Idealization of Motherhood and How It Has Undermined Women, published this year by Free Press and available at good booksellers everywhere. We have a couple callers who have been very patient. I want to get to the phone lines. We do have lines open. The number is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phones right now. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Susan Douglas.
Yes, hi, Susan. I just read your article that you co-authored in The Nation, and I was really interested to hear about how you had gotten slammed regarding attachment parenting, which William Sears, I think, has promoted in his books.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about that?
I talk about getting slammed?
Yeah, for what attachment parenting is and, you know, how that's different than other kinds of parenting or what they had to say about that that they didn't like.
Sure. Attachment parenting is, and I'm going to caricature it a little bit, but, you know, let me preface this by saying what we have to remember are there fads in child rearing, and they come and go. And so one generation clings, you know, determinedly to one set of, you know, notions about how best to raise children, and then, you know, another set of expectations comes along. And so when I had a baby, for example, we were not supposed to sleep with our children because there was a concern that you might smother them. And, you know, there were just a whole different set of expectations. Attachment parenting, it basically means, as I understand it, that you wear your kid, you know, for about 3 to 5 years. You strap the kid on and don't let the kid go. And you sleep with the child. The child becomes the absolute center of your universe, and the kid is physically attached to you, and everything must be seen through the child's eyes. So, for example, if you walk into the kitchen and discover that your two-year-old has gotten into, let's say, a big jar of jam and smeared it all over the kitchen floor, right? You're not supposed to say, oh, my God, you know, oh, no, and then, you know, figure out how you're going to clean it up. No, you're supposed to stop and smile and see this through your kid's eyes and see what fun it is. Now, you know, I'm sorry. what if there's another kid there? And then, you know, what if the dog is rolling in it? I mean, you know, this is, you know, it's just gotten so, what Sears proposes is that we look at everything through our kids' eyes, and that we wear our kids all the time so that your worldview as an adult female is completely obliterated. And now,
Susan,
you know,
what happens if you've got like 3 kids aged 1 through 4? I mean, do you have to be, like, work out with weights to be able to raise your kids?
I guess you strap them all on. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things is that you're actually supposed to eject your partner from the bed and put all the kids in the bed, and your partner goes sleep elsewhere until the kids have gotten tired sleeping with you. Now, having said this, there are many young, and I would say educated, professional women who have really gotten into attachment parenting and really gotten into Dr. Sears. And I think one of the reasons is that these young women, some of them have left academic positions or left professional jobs to stay at home because they want to do that or they can do it. And these are overachieving women, right? They're very accomplished young women. So it's not surprising that they would bring the same kind of, you know, energy and determination and knowledge to mothering. I just think that Sears has tapped into this and pushed it to its preposterous levels. And I think the caller was referring to a review of the book in The Nation, which was, I was very happy with the review. It was a great review. But one of the things the reviewer said is, oh, I've gotten into attachment parenting and, you know, what's so bad about that? And, you know, on one level, nothing if that's what you choose. But I think what's concerning about it is that it really is about making mothers utterly subservient to their children 24 hours a day.
Yeah, this seems like the mommy myth on steroids.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like you go around, if you're a mother, and you see these attachment parent moms who do nothing but dote on their kid, and you feel like you're a total loser. I mean,
that's.
I mean, I think you were being generous, if anything, in your assessment. We've got Susan J. Douglas on the line, co-author of the book The Mommy Myth. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 3, Champaign County, you're on the air with Susan Douglas. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air with Susan Douglas.
Right. Sorry to waste the time. You haven't mentioned Christian Wright. I think you're looking mainly at new momism in the media, but I wonder if you studied, you know, the whole campaign against alternate child rearing. I mean, there was a campaign against daycare centers that wasn't just the Christian Right. It was also like the Heritage Foundation, and I mean, it was coincident with this, with some real hysterical stuff going on about daycare centers and child abuse. A lot of which didn't happen. Not that child abuse isn't a pernicious thing, but daycare centers that were accused were, you know, like sort of after many years of torturous trials and stuff, a number of notorious ones were actually, it was found to be wrong. And I wanted you, that's sort of one instance of the whole thing, I think, but I wanted you to say something on that, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Yeah, Susan?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely, we talk about this in the book, and in two different ways. One is, I think probably one of the cases you may be thinking about most explicitly is the McMartin daycare scandal, which broke in 1984. And when that story broke, and when we do a lot about it in the book, those teachers who were accused of sexually molesting kids were talked about and written about in the news media as if they were guilty. And there were stories in which even the word allegedly was not used. It was just presumed that they had done it. And, you know, there was a whole campaign, listen to the children, listen to the children. The children are telling the truth. That completely demonized these people. And, you know, these were not the only ones. There was another scandal at a place called Little Rascals. That later proved to be false. There were quite a few of them around the country. There was this hysteria in 84 and 85 that began with the McMartin case. And as the caller may know, it later turned out that the woman who had initially made the charges that launched this whole investigation, which led to the most expensive criminal trial in American history, the McMartin case, it turned out that she was mentally ill, and she was unable to distinguish fiction from, sort of illusion from reality, and it was on her charges that this whole story snowballed out of proportion. So the caller is absolutely right. We do talk about that in the book and the way in which the media got into what we call media panics about daycare that very much demonized daycare. And then there's the second part of his question, which is, do we look at the kind of the political aspects of daycare? And absolutely, there's an entire chapter on daycare that looks at the evolution of attacks on daycare, starting with the 1971 Nixon veto of what was then and what still would have been the most comprehensive daycare bill ever passed. It had massive bipartisan support, and it went to Nixon's desk, and he vetoed it. And he vetoed it because it was thought that he needed to placate the right wing of the Republican Party, and the person who wrote the veto language was Pat Buchanan. And we have that veto language in there. And ever since then, there has been a combination of political right and Christian right attacks on daycare, and we do trace that throughout that chapter. So I'm very glad that the caller mentioned it.
Yeah, Susan Douglas, let me ask you about it, though. When we think of the Christian right, the organized Christian right that's certainly in ascendance in the current presidential administration, you know, we know that they're admittedly and self-profess hostility to feminism and to a lot of to the social programs or funding programs that would make it easier to be a mother or to raise families. But at the same time, is the Christian right really pushing the mommy myth? Or because I always sense they were more the June Cleaver crowd. I mean, are they mommy myth promoters as well?
Oh, yeah, because, you know, now what you have is, I'll tell you something else June Cleaver wasn't expected to do. June Cleaver was not expected to homeschool the beaver on top of everything else, right?
Yeah.
Now we've got the whole homeschooling thing. Now, don't get me wrong. There are people who, they have their religious reasons. They want to homeschool. They're going to homeschool. There are other people who homeschool because the school situations where they are pretty impossible. And they feel like the only way their kid's going to get a decent education is for, you know, homeschooling to occur. There has been an explosion in homeschooling in the last 5 to 10 years in this country. But now there's been a push, particularly by the Christian right, that homeschooling is pretty much the only way to go. And the mark of what gets you a real halo as a mother these days is to homeschool. Now, you know, I have to say, my hat's off to anybody who can do this.
It's unthinkable to me.
But it is unthinkable to me, too. I don't have a degree in early childhood education, you know. But the notion, and again, I think what we're really trying to say in this book is that, you know, one size does not fit all. And one of the things we really try to take on is the way the media have constructed these so-called wars between mothers, you know,
mm-hmm.
Between working mothers and stay-at-home mothers. You know, are there tensions between working mothers and stay-at-home mothers? Sure. But have the media exaggerated and magnified this all out of proportion to sell magazines and TV shows? You bet they have, you know. And, you know, I'm a working mother. I'm friends with stay-at-home mothers. Guess what? We schlep each other's kids around all the time. We look out for each other's kids. You know, we want the same things. But I do think that these wars have been so circulated, you know, in the media, that it's very easy for us to see this kind of conflict laid out and to then internalize it and say, oh, there are these wars. There must be these wars. I guess I have to take sides, you know. So the way in which the media kind of missed into the environment in which we live, a set of black and white choices and black and white conflicts that we then internalize, it's a very, you know, insidious but powerful way in which the media operates.
We're talking to Susan J. Douglas, co-author of the new book, The Mommy Myth, on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live. We have a couple callers very patiently waiting I want to get to in a second. We do have lines open at 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455. Let me tell you right now that the next 3 weeks, our guests here on Media Matters, 1 week from today will be Amy Goodman, 2 weeks from today, my dear friend John Nichols, and 3 weeks from today, Janine Garofalo. So that's our lineup for the next 3 weeks here in Media Matters. I do hope you will join us. Susan, before we get back to the phone calls, I want to ask you specifically about one group of mothers that seems to get a special type of attention in our culture, and that's welfare mothers.
Yeah.
How do welfare mothers fit into the mommy myth?
Well, you know, it was really interesting because, you know, when you're going through and doing research on this stuff, you sort of notice, you know, what becomes really prominent during a certain period. And by the late 80s, celebrity mothers were everywhere. In the early 1970s, there were hardly any celebrity mothers on the covers of magazines. By the late 80s, celebrity mothers were everywhere. So that was on the one side, you know, of the, you know, media diptych, you know, where these everywhere, these idealized celebrity mothers. And at the same time, of course, you couldn't help but notice that on the other side, in increasing frequency, were welfare mothers. They were the other side. They were the mothers we were not supposed to emulate. They were the mothers we were supposed to look down on, to hold in contempt. And so what was really important to do in this book was to put those kinds of mothers together, because they weren't together in the same place in the media. You know, the celebrity moms were in glossy magazines, and welfare mothers were in the news as kind of objects of journalistic scrutiny.
And derision.
And so it was really important to juxtapose them in the book, and that's what we did. And so, you know, I looked at what I believe is every single news story put out on all three networks about welfare mothers, beginning in 1968 and going up to 2000. And, you know, the media, not surprisingly, and this will hardly surprise you, focused on the very infinitesimal minority of welfare mothers who provided the most sensational kinds of stories. So, for example, most welfare mothers, 80% of welfare mothers, had two kids or less. 75% of welfare mothers were off of the rolls anywhere from 3 to 5 years. More welfare mothers were white than African-American or women of color. Okay, but what did the media focus on? African-American, inner-city, teenage, you know, unmarried welfare mothers whose mothers and grandmothers were also on welfare, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they conveyed a picture of, you know, what was called the, you know, cycle of dependency, the cycle of poverty, of a group of women who were just so irresponsible, so promiscuous, and so neglectful as mothers that the only thing to do, really, right, was to, as Clinton put it, end welfare as we know it. And I, the book really lays out how these stereotypes evolved, and I think one of the most pernicious, awful things to come out of this was the stereotype of the African-American mother as a bad mother. And so we really wanted to take on the media demonizing of welfare mothers, because I think it's just been sinful.
Yeah, it's a very powerful chapter, chapter 6 in the book. We're talking to Susan J. Douglas, co-author of The Mommy Myth with Meredith W. Michaels. We've got a couple callers who've been very patiently waiting on the phone line, so let's get back to them. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Susan Douglas.
Yeah, there's actually two comments, and they feed into you know, your previous discussion. One was this, it's a new concept to me, the attachment or whatever it is, the child attachment or something. They're supposed to pay a lot of attention. Is that the terminology or not?
Yes, it's called attachment parenting.
Oh, okay. It seems to me that it seems in terms of research that comes out that the most important model in a family is the husband and wife. And when we look at the divorce and the impact of divorce, that's the model of loving, you know, all that kind of thing. So if you're doing all this attention, you know, it's one of the problems that there was so much attention to the children, not that there shouldn't be. But I'll let you comment on that. The second one was this whole issue of our society so taken up, you know, in this workaholic phase. Productivity is up basically because people are doing the jobs of, you know, it used to be it was three people doing the job. It was down to two, and then one's doing the job of, you know, all of them. My daughter married an Englishman and had the first grandchild in England. And, you know, that whole perspective there in terms of holidays, where they have the time. And, in fact, when had the first child, they expect that the husband, you know, the father, actually takes off a week, you know, that kind of thing. And what was sort of interesting and that he worked for actually a company in the States here and was doing work over in England. They were living there then. And ended up that, you know, they don't allow that here, you know, that kind of thing. So anyway, I'd like you to comment, you know, you have just a greater chance to be a parent, as far as I'm concerned, in an environment that actually has holidays. It's the same way coming up with the Easter. They have time off, and they can spend time with families. Where, you know, I've been in some homes where they have a couple of kids, both of them working. I mean, it's just chaotic. It's just absolutely chaotic. So anyway, I'll let you comment.
Thank you. It seems, Susan, there are really two issues there. The second one relates to a lot of what we've talked about the support networks, but also this, the pressure on people to work. People are working longer and longer, both men and women, than they have for a couple of generations in this country, more hours worked, which leaves less time for family life. And then the first question was, I think, implicit was the question of single parenting and the difficulty of that with the increase in divorces. So what are your thoughts there?
Well, the call is absolutely right about, you know, our workaholic culture. And, you know, Juliet Shore has written about this and has documented that the amount of leisure time in the United States has declined steadily since the 1980s. And, of course, we have the shortest vacations of anybody, you know, in the industrialized world. And so you have one trend in which you have decline of leisure time, increased workaholism at work, right, going up, up, up. At the same time that the standards for being a perfect mother are going up, 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 and mothers are caught smack dab in between these two, you know, mm-hmm. sort of no place to...
Yeah, it's an impossible situation.
It is absolutely impossible. The caller is very right about that. And, you know, to get back to, you know, how hard it is for single parents, I mean, I am married, and when I had a baby, my sense really was that the nuclear family was a failure, that the correct adult-to-kid ratio was 3-to-1, at least, not 2-to-1. And so if you're a single person, it is, you know, it's very tough. And I had a taste of it because when I had an infant, my husband was commuting, and so he was away 4 nights a week. And I got a taste of what it was like to be a single mother. And I had health care. I had access to an excellent daycare center. You know, and I found it very, very hard. And we have very little support mechanisms for people who are doing it on their own.
Is all this pressure put stress on marriages too, though? I mean, between the work, the lack of leisure time, and then the high demands and expectations, that can't be very healthy for, you know, parental relations either.
Well, you know, one of the myths that we see, especially in all these, you know, in these celebrity mom, you know, things that come out in Style and People and all these kinds of magazines, is that, you know, marriage becomes more blissful once the baby comes. Now, any honest person who's had children can tell you that that's not really how it works. Because the first thing that happens is that you and your partner cannot have a conversation for about 6 years unless you hire a babysitter so you can go out and have one. And, you know, having kids is very tough on a relationship, as it is.
Yeah.
But then to have all of the... you know, schlepping and developmental stuff and the cultivating of the child's little psyche and this and that added on to everything else, I do think it makes it more stressful, you know, and not just for mothers. I mean, you know, the book really is about the mommy myth and the pressures on mothers to be perfect, but there are plenty of pressures on fathers, too.
We have time for our final caller. Line 4, Champagne, you're on the air with Susan J. Douglas.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
So this leads good into my question, actually. It's good to identify these problems in the workplace, and I help working mothers in the nursing home industry organized in Central Illinois. And my question for you is, I guess it's a comment and a question, is that number one, you know, given all these, I wouldn't call it workaholicism or whatever the last caller described it as, although I agree with them, I would call this being forced by our employers to work these hours because we're working at very low wages, and a lot of workers right now are given a choice in the workplace. Number one, have health insurance at work, or number two, you can take a $2 or $3 an hour pay cut to receive benefits, which doesn't work out either way for a family. And my question is, knowing all these problems are out there, what do you think is the solution, and how do you think the mothers that you're describing, what do you think they can do about? What do you think they can do to solve these problems?
Thank you, caller. And we've only got about a minute and a half left, and that's an excellent question to end on, Susan.
It's a great question. And you know, I think one of the most important inventions of the women's movement was the consciousness-raising group, in which women got together and talked about the myths that were holding them down back then. And it might seem like an insignificant first step, but the consciousness-raising group was crucial in leading to political change in this country, because once women got together and got power from each other and sustenance from each other, they decided to go out and get political. And the voices of mothers in this country have not been heard. It's time for us first to talk back to the mommy myth, to rip the veneer off of it, and then once we feel empowered by that, and I do think it's very empowering to make fun of this stuff and to laugh at it, is to then become more political. I do think that whether it's at the local level, at the union level, at the school level, at the national level, we need to be emailing our congressional representatives, our presidential candidate of choice, and ask, when are you finally going to start doing something for families? And that includes for kids. You know, we're supposed to love our individual kids, right? But what about all of the kids of this country who deserve a better break? So I think it's time for us to get better organized and to become political.
Susan J. Douglas, what's the response been to the book so far?
You know, I have to say, there have been some right-wing pot shots here and there, but for the most part, the response has been great, and it's been especially great among young stay-at-home mothers in their 20s and 30s who grew up in a different era than I did, and they just feel like they had no idea what they were getting into when they had kids, because they were so surrounded by this mythology of joy and perfection. And they've been very grateful for the book, because they felt kind of censored, like they're not allowed to say how hard it is, and they're not allowed to say how tired they are or exasperated they are. I mean, oh, they love their children. That's not the point. You
the
know?
Book, of course, we're talking about, The Mommy Myth, co-authored by our guest today, Susan J. Douglas. Susan, I hear the band tuning up in the background. It means I've got to get out of the studio. Thank you so much for being our guest, Susan. Good luck with the book, and continued success with everything you do.
Thanks, Bob. Back at you.
I'm Bob McChesney, your host of Media Matters. I'll be back 1 week from today with our guest, Amy Goodman, and I'd like to thank Victor Picard, my producer, for all his great work. See you then.
Monday through Friday at 3, join us for Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Tomorrow at 3, with the presidential election drawing near, September 11th has become a powerful and volatile political issue. Host Gretchen Helfrich and guests examine the politics of 9/11 on Odyssey tomorrow afternoon at 3 here on AM 580. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with a high in the lower 50s and north winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 20s and north winds 5 to 10 miles per hour in the evening, shifting to the east around 5 miles per hour after midnight. Tomorrow, mostly sunny in the morning, then becoming partly sunny. The high in the upper 50s with southeast winds around 5 miles per hour in the morning, shifting to the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour in the afternoon. This is WILL Urbana, listener-supported public radio. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.